If you had to name them right now, what would you say are the biggest economic forces that affect your life? Where you were born, who your parents are or were, how the industry you work in is doing? How about 12 people who you'll probably never meet, who sit in a room every 6 weeks and fight about how our economy is doing? I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. Those 12 people are the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee, the ones who set interest rates. And this week, we're talking to someone who has been in that room. And we asked him to make the case that you should actually care what those 12 people are up to, because the Fed can feel awfully far away from work, kids, bills, all that everyday stuff. He makes a pretty good argument, but I want to know if it convinces you. As always, come share your thoughts with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We'll get to the Fed in a little bit, but we're going to kick things off the way we normally do, by stealing some terms from the world of finance and asking our panelists to go long and short, that is, bet on or against some topics in the world of news and business. And this week, we have Van Newkirk II, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and Marketplace's own Nancy Marshall Genzer. Welcome to you both.
Hey.
Hey.
All right. I know we have a lot of political stuff to digest, but we're doing it in our long and short framework. So, Nancy, go ahead. What's your long here?
Well, I am going to go long, believe it or not, on Congress enacting some kind of campaign finance reform, incremental reform, before you both burst out laughing. But, you know, there have been some bills that were introduced, and they would both change the composition of the Federal Elections Commission, the FEC, which is just toothless right now. It has six members, three Democrats, three Republicans. They are constantly deadlocking. One bill would change that and make it five members, including a chairperson with very broad powers. You know, members of Congress, I think, are wanting to do something. If they have the majority and if the president would sign legislation, we'll know more about that after November.
I am receiving this with a skeptical eyebrow.
But
an intrigued one.
I know. I hear the cocked eyebrow in your voice. But Lizzie, think about how much time members of Congress from both parties are spending raising money. And they hate it. They universally hate it.
Well, if they hate it, though, what happens to the actual moneyed interest to which they are beholden? They probably don't hate it. And
well,
so what happens when someone goes through with moving on a finance reform bill and the people back home aren't too happy?
You're right, Van. I mean, yeah, they obviously, these big donors aren't just giving money to be nice. They want to influence legislation, and it's all part of a big lobbying machine, and fundraising is a part of that. But some corporations actually would like some campaign finance limits because they get tired of being hit up for money all the time.
All right, Van, I know you're also looking at this with a political eye, so what are you long?
I'm long on mail-in voting. So we just had the California primaries, and California has had for a few years the ability to mail in your ballots for the primaries and the fall elections as well. I just think it's good policy. So I think it's good to allow people as many avenues to vote as possible. People tend to have more optimism in a system where they have more ways to vote.
You know, I used to live in Oregon. Fabulous, beautiful state. And I loved the mail-in voting there. But I have to say, I think most of the states that allow mail-in voting are blue. And from what I've seen from states like Texas, they are more interested in, you know, being careful about who votes, making sure you have an ID. I don't know that I see those states kind of letting up on the reins a little bit and allowing online voting or mail-in voting.
Oh, definitely not. And actually, one more level to that, aside from California, most states that have the most open voting rules and regulations don't have that many people of color either. I think we have a couple of experiments happening, say, in Illinois, where that's being challenged. But I do think you're right.
Nancy, give me your short, because I'm 100% behind this one.
I don't think the Fed is going to raise interest rates at its meeting next week.
Does anybody?
Yes, believe it or not, some people do. And Janet Yellen, you know, she's basically asked point blank, are you going to raise interest rates next week? And she said, I've said about 18 times, it depends on the data. But, you know, if you look at the data, if you look at the May jobs report, it was awful. Only 38,000 jobs created. The stock market certainly isn't expecting the Fed to raise interest rates. I think they do pay a little attention to that. And, you know, in the face of that jobs report, I don't see how they could.
Van, give me your short, because you're staying in the politics arena, but I'm particularly fascinated by this one.
Well, I am short on Paul Ryan. Paul Ryan said, I believe Tuesday, that comments by Donald Trump on Judge Curiel were, quote, the textbook definition of racism. But then later on in his speech reiterated his very lukewarm support, but still support, and saying that he would still vote for the man. And those things to me are incongruent.
But this is the question I have, which is, okay, I think a lot of Republicans who have backed Donald Trump are in a somewhat similar position. But I don't see an Eric Cantor-like challenge to Paul Ryan in the House. Do you see a way that he could lose power within his own party? Because right now, I'm not really seeing it.
Well, he's doing a couple things also to irk the Freedom Caucus as well. I think we're going to see it happen with the vote on the Puerto Rico debt relief bill as well. Mm-hmm. So I actually don't think there's many ways that he will be challenged. And I think he knows that. And I think he's acting accordingly.
Van Newkirk II from The Atlantic, Nancy Marshall-Genzer from Marketplace. Thank you both very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. One thing we like to do here is bring in actors, artists, and other well-known people and ask them about work and money and how it shaped their lives or taught them formative lessons. It's called the Marketplace Quiz, and here's our producer, Raghu Manavalan, with this week's guest.
My name is Sloane Crosley. I am a writer and author, most recently, of The Clasp.
First question, fill in the blank. Money can't buy you happiness, but it can buy you.
Oh, wow. Money can buy you a really big house to ruminate on all the ways your life has gone horribly awry. should I keep going? There's some famous actress, and I'm both going to forget the name of the actress. I want to say it's of the Elizabeth Taylor ilk. And I'm going to butcher the quote as well, but something along the lines of, I'd rather be crying in the back of a limo than happy on the back of a Schwinn. I actually don't agree with that, but mostly because I really hate limousines. Philosophically, I get it.
In a next life, what would your career be?
I can choose anything?
Anything.
Great. In my next life, I would be an archaeologist. It's what I actually went to school for. It's what I wanted to be. And I suppose that there's some sort of loose metaphor or theme between what I used to want to be and what I am now and the fact that I'm digging up other people's stories.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
It's the fact that you're a factory of one. So I used to work for a large corporation. I worked for Random House for almost 10 years. And, you know, even when you were doing things that weren't directly work-related, let's say you were mailing a check, someone else was paying for that 5 seconds when you were mailing that check. Mm-hmm. And when you're freelance, which, you know, is basically what writers are, no matter how many prizes and awards they have, they're freelance. So much is left up to you. It's your responsibility. And so having to produce everything all by yourself, whether it's, you know, filling in a W-9 or writing a novel, it can be overwhelming.
When did you realize writing could be an actual career?
You know, it's gradual. I always want there to be this moment. You know, in the movies, there's always a moment when you realize you're in love with your best friend or you quit your job and you're taking this goldfish and that's it. but it's really a gradual process. It didn't dawn on me. I guess the closest I have to a sort of revelatory moment was my first book tour for I Was Told There'd Be Cake. I was in Seattle And I was looking at the New York Times bestseller list because I had my job still, so I was looking for other authors on it. And I went to an internet cafe. How Seattle is that? Retro. And I went to an internet cafe, and I was looking through the list, and I saw my book title and my name, and you're kind of used to seeing your own name, so it didn't register at first. And then I realized that the book was on the Times list, and I screamed, I yelped, and I started crying, and this very nice woman who worked at the cafe bought me a vegan muffin.
Because Seattle.
And I realized that maybe I could do this eventually. I mean, it still took me another 4 years to quit. Things dawn on me slowly, I guess.
What is something everyone should own, no matter the cost?
A really good mattress. I mean, I think it's all well and good when you're young to sleep on, you know, it feels very glamorous to sleep on balsa wood that's just, you know, covered in toilet paper rolls or whatever you use for support. But a really good mattress, I don't think you can go wrong with a good night's sleep.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started?
Really, I wish that somebody had advised me to have a better answer for that question. That somebody one day will ask you for advice to pass something on, and you should really have something prepared. I mean, I think that there's, you know, write everything down, but that's Joan Didion, I think. That's not me. One great piece of advice that I received when I was in college was from a professor who said, a creative writing professor who said, you don't have to wait to be great. And I think that's really good advice for when you are a teenager and you think, well, I can write a great novel, or I can write a great essay, or I can, you know, paint a great painting when I'm older. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's necessarily so true now. I don't think, you know, the next generation is afraid of being great, but there is a little voice inside you that says, okay, well, this is my practice. And you shouldn't treat it as practice. You should try to take yourself, you know, take your work seriously, not yourself seriously. But you should try to take your work seriously as soon as possible.
Sloane Crosley's novel, The Clasp, is out in paperback now. So now to those 12 people, the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. They meet this upcoming week, and they probably won't raise interest rates. At least that's what the market's betting. But as I mentioned at the top of the show, we are bringing on someone who has been in that room making the decision about rates and discussing a whole bunch of other things that, even though they can feel far away, have a big impact on you. He's Narayana Kotra-Lakota, the former president of the Minneapolis Fed and now an economics professor at the University of Rochester. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
I want to start by playing a clip from Janet Yellen's speech last week. This is from the Q&A where she got asked, of course, about when the Fed might move on interest rates. Let's listen.
I know market participants really want to know exactly what's going to happen. And it is only on rare occasions when we're able to provide that kind of guidance. There is, as I said, about 18 times no preset plan.
So we get back to the mantra of data dependent, data dependent, data dependent. I want to know from you, this is a game we like to play here, what is Janet Yellen thinking going into these meetings?
I think it'll be really interesting to hear from her on that. I suspect she'll be more open to her ideas about that, though, once she's no longer in the position. But I think that the general perspective of people who are coming into the meeting is there's a bunch of data flow coming through about a wide variety of economic conditions, and you're somehow trying to put that together into formulating a decision about interest rates. I think there's been a considerable amount of murkiness about what exactly is the committee trying to achieve. To be even a little more precise about that, you know, the committee has stated that it's trying to keep inflation close to 2%. Mm-hmm. Well, really, for the last 3 years, they've been engaging in that tightening of monetary policy, first by suggesting they were going to stop the buying of long-term assets, then stopping the purchase of long-term assets. These are purchases that are designed to put downward pressure on long-term yields and thereby stimulate spending and stimulate upward pressure on inflation. So you're taking a step backwards from your goal, even though you're not achieving your goal. And this has continued for quite some time. And I think this is a source of real confusion for market participants.
You know, the mission of this show is where the economy meets real life. And I can bet that there will be people who listen to this and say, wait, 2% inflation? What? Who are these people who go into a meeting? I want you to make the case for them that the Fed is something they should care about.
Yeah, I would actually say it something more strongly. The Fed is basically one of the main forces that helps keep the economy stable. It's one of the aspects, as Americans think about who they should have as president, for example, one of the things we know that president will have the opportunity to do is appoint a chair of the Board of Governors in January 2018. Of course, that person will have to be confirmed by the Senate as well. That might be a decision, of course, to reappoint the current chair, Janet Yellen. That person will have an enormous influence on the course of the U.S. economy. Now, how does that work? It works through the fact that when adverse shocks hit the economy, the Fed, by lowering interest rates, has the ability to stimulate demand when other forces are pushing downward on demand. So that if there's a shock to people's housing prices, for example, the kind we saw in 2008, that kind of shock will lead people to cut back on spending. By lowering interest rates, the Fed is able to offset that shock. That helps to keep employment higher than it would be otherwise, and it keeps prices higher than it would be otherwise. Now, the lower inflation expectations are, the lower interest rates are on average, and that gives the Fed less room, essentially, to play this role of keeping the economy stable. So you have to become more worried about recessionary shocks feeding through into the economy if the Fed doesn't have as much room to help the economy.
You know, you have been one of the most, I would say, significant examples of someone radically changing their mind in public office. You used to be against stimulus, saying that monetary policy couldn't really move the employment market. And then you've come around as really a super dove in Fed jargon. What was that process like?
You're charged as a member of the Federal Reserve Committee to achieve certain goals. And the goals you're trying to achieve are to keep inflation close to 2% and promote maximum employment. When I was first on the committee, I had a vision or a model of the macroeconomy in mind where I thought inflation would return back to 2% despite the depth of the recession relatively rapidly. That model of vision of the economy proved to be wrong. And if you've got certain things you're supposed to be doing on the public's behalf, you have to be willing to admit, I think, that you're when you're wrong in order to be able
but
to
But not
make,
a lot
make
of people
policy.
In public life admit that they're wrong. I mean, was it scary to do that?
You know, nobody likes to admit they're wrong. On the other hand, the only way you can admit to learning is to, in some sense, admit that you've been wrong in the past. So I viewed it as just a positive growth opportunity for myself. Is I was updating what I knew about the economy, and somebody who was interested in being learning about the economy, as I've been for a long time, was a good thing to be able to do that. I think there has been different reactions from different people about my change in policy stance. In general, I think the reaction has been fairly positive, but I didn't do it with that in mind. I did it because it was my job to do what I could to achieve the goals of the institution.
You have written a fair amount about increasing inequality. Do you think the Fed can play a role in decreasing it? Should it?
I think through its achieving of its goals, it definitely helps to play a role in reducing inequality. If you're able to foster and facilitate a more rapid return to full employment from a situation where you have high unemployment, I think that really is helpful in terms of lowering inequality. My goal in the pieces I've written about inequality have really been to try to get some facts on the table. You know, one set of facts is that, in fact, the big increase in inequality in wealth didn't take place after the Fed's more extraordinary policy initiatives like so-called quantitative easing. It took place before that during the downturn, during 2007 to 2010. So you had a very big increase. The poorer Americans took a much bigger hit to their wealth than richer Americans.
Well, is that to counter the idea that, say, QE3 or whatever helped people at the top because they're more entrenched in the markets?
I'm describing the facts, and people can take away from them what they want. My own reading of that is that, boy, if we could have done more to blunt the impact of the recession, and not have such a deep recession 2007 to 2010, that would have been the most effective thing we could have done to keep inequality from growing over the last 6 or 7 years.
What would you do?
You know, I think that the Fed over this time frame in terms of monetary policy took a lot of very beneficial steps. But with the benefit of hindsight, I wish we had taken some of those steps more rapidly. You know, you talk about the launching of large-scale asset purchases. You talked about QE3 or QE2. Why wasn't there just one big QE? As I say, with the benefit of hindsight, I was on the committee, so it is with the benefit of hindsight. Going into the next crisis, the next event of this kind, I hope that future Feds learn from the experiences of this one and are able to move with more alacrity to try to blunt the impact of such a deep recession.
We currently have the first female Fed chair, but all of the Fed governors are white. 3 of the 5 are men. Do you think that we need a Fed that looks more like the rest of this country?
The whole notion of the Federal Reserve is about the idea that diversity is a good thing in the making of monetary policy. That's why we have representatives from around the country. And the act charges the president and the Senate with appointing members of the Board of Governors who are representative of a wide range of walks of life. Yeah, I think it would be good to have a Fed that racially was more representative, a Federal Open Market Committee in particular, that was more representative of the diversity we have in this country.
I mean, because I look at the effects of the recession and certainly in the labor market and see the disproportionate impact on minorities. And I wonder, gosh, was that something you guys talked about when you were on the committee?
So, you know, I'm only able to talk about what happened in 2009, 2010, because everything yep. else remains private. But in 2010, I went through the transcripts, again, with the benefit of hindsight, and really there was no mention of African-American unemployment, for example, which was extraordinarily high during that time frame. Part of that could be attributable to the lack of diversity you describe. Part of it is just the way I think the policy conversation gets framed. We talk about the diversity in the economy that has been set up for us historically to talk about. If you read through the transcripts, it's a very structured conversation. I think there are very easy steps to highlight minority unemployment more in with the presentations that are made to the committee that would immediately, I think, bring this more to the committee's attention. With that said, I think that it would be a good thing for the FOMC to be, in terms of the racial diversity, to be more reflective of the kind of great diversity we have in this country.
Arianna Kocher-Lakota, professor of economics at the University of Rochester, former president of the Minneapolis Fed. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the great questions.
One part of our conversation with Narayana Kocher-Lakota that didn't make it into our interview is his worry about the potential economic repercussions of a Brexit. That's shorthand for whether the UK decides to leave the European Union. Brits will vote on the 23rd of this month to stay in or leave. One of the many things at stake is London's position as the world's financial center. An influential survey last year said the city was the biggest, best, and most competitive place on the planet to be in the money business. A Brexit could mean London loses that title. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story, plus a look at Americans in the UK and what happens to them if Britain votes to leave.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, popped up in London to present the UK with its annual economic forecast. The prospects? Pretty good, so long as Britain does not vote to leave the EU.
The consequences would be negative. Less consumption, less investment, higher prices, less jobs, so higher unemployment.
And she said London's status as a financial centre could be fatally undermined.
It's going to be pretty bad to very, very bad.
Also anxious about Brexit is the Lloyd's insurance market, a pillar of London's financial centre for more than 300 years. The CEO, Inga Beale.
Potential departure from the EU is a fundamental threat to the Lloyd's market.
As Britain is in the EU, she says, Lloyd's can do business freely anywhere in the 28-nation bloc. Brexit would make matters much more difficult.
For Lloyd's, we would have to individually negotiate with each country how we could trade in that country. Very costly way of doing business.
bankers worry too. Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan says he may cut 4,000 UK jobs if there's a Brexit. HSBC and Goldman Sachs also expressed alarm that Britain might be cutting itself off from its European markets. So could London lose its crown as Europe's financial capital? No chance, says pro-Brexit economist Gerard Lyons.
London will remain the financial centre of Europe. London's competition is no longer Frankfurt, Paris or Amsterdam as it used to be in the past. London's competition is New York, Singapore, Hong Kong.
And he claims London's preeminence is actually threatened by ever-encroaching EU regulation. Even some London investment bankers like Tarun Jotwani are not buying the doomsday scenario.
You think you might be shut out of financial markets to some extent in continental Europe if there is a Brexit?
I don't think so, because I think London is far too important. I think there's an adjustment, but I don't believe that shutting out happens.
He says he wouldn't pull out of London, though he might have to set up a subsidiary in continental Europe. And he remains very much opposed to Brexit.
Disruption can create unintended consequences, and that's what we are afraid of.
Disruption in one of the world's biggest financial centres, he says, is something the world, and that includes Britain, could do without. This is a matter for the Brits to decide. But since the repercussions will affect the US's biggest market, Europe, we thought we should take a look at the issue through American eyes. We've been talking to some of the 200,000 American expats who live and work in the UK. The Odeon Cinema in Leicester Square, a world-famous venue for movie premieres. Recently, it unveiled a rather unusual production.
We had a premiere, a gala black tie red carpet premiere that rivaled the premieres of any Hollywood blockbuster. And yet this was a documentary film about Brexit.
That's Hunter Dubose, a London-based, American-born investment banker. He co-produced and partly financed Brexit, the movie.
We, the people, are being cajoled, frightened, and bullied into surrendering our democracy and freedom. This film is a rallying cry.
The movie urges the Brits to vote to pull out of the EU in this month's referendum.
I feel that this country is my adoptive home as well. And for me, I feel passionately about Britain leaving the European Union.
Hunter Dubose believes that leaving the EU will set Britain and its businesses free.
Right now, we are strangled by regulations, laws, and policies originating from mainstream Europe.
You think your business will do much better if this country is outside the EU?
Without question.
Other American expats living here are far happier about the European Union. Shara Terry Young is an accountant from Baltimore. She wants the EU to go much further down the road towards political union and turn itself into a federation.
Because the United States is is all about federalism, and federalism makes sense to me as an American. You're stronger when you work together.
She's living and working in London because her husband is European and has the right to settle in any of the 28 member states. Now, she says, the British referendum campaign is turning her off the UK.
You see more and more headlines about immigrants are buying all the houses, they're taking all of the jobs, they're stealing all the benefits. It's not very welcoming, and it doesn't really make us want to stay in the long term.
There is a tide of anti-EU propaganda like this Brexit song. Another American expat who finds this a little worrying is Christian Del Valier. He arrived here 17 years ago from Texas. He now runs an ecological investment fund and advisory business.
A large number of our staff are EU nationals. I would be concerned, certainly, if retaining the expertise that I currently have on the team became more difficult due to a Brexit.
A British government, even after a Brexit, would hardly try to expel the 3 million EU nationals currently working in the UK. The economy would collapse. But Del Valier is worried that the barriers would go up and he'd be cut off from his many European investors and clients.
Would you consider relocating if there were a Brexit?
There could be a very elevated chance that we would take the decision that our business was best based elsewhere.
In continental Europe?
Yes.
Political and business leaders in Britain and around the world have lined up to warn that Brexit will have dire consequences for the UK.
The Bank of England, the IMF, the OECD, even President Obama have all weighed in. But John Scott, an American expat living here in Wimbledon, is not impressed with the warnings of almost biblical disaster.
We're going to have wars, we're going to have pestilence, we're going to have
a plague of locusts,
and all the other plagues that befell Egypt are going to befall England. That's absolute rubbish. Are they joking? Come on.
Scott is fiercely pro-Brexit and furious at any suggestion that Britain could not prosper outside the EU as a fully independent, self-governing nation.
It just really galls me no end. So while I'm American, I still think that what's good for Britain is to bloody damn get out and keep your sovereignty.
But it must be said, all foreign interventions in this British decision seem to backfire. When President Obama uttered his warning against Brexit, support for the Leave campaign picked up. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Brexit decision is one of the big economic stories of the year, and you can stay with Marketplace for the latest. Since it's summer, we're continuing our vacation-themed conversation from last week about traveling with kids, how to make it work, and how to make it affordable. For Sarah Beaudet and David Keyes, traveling is a state of being. Back in 2015, they quit their jobs and sold all their stuff to travel. They change locations every couple of months and bring their 3-year-old son along. Sarah and David write the blog The Luxpats. They started in Luxembourg. They blog about traveling on a budget, and we spoke to them from Budapest.
We found that travel, like anything, is all about finding routines, finding hacks, building rituals that work, and then just repeating them and iterating on them.
The way we travel is slow. So we stay in one location for minimum 1 month. We'd shoot for 2 to 3 months. And that simplifies everything. We don't live like we're on vacation. When we're in Copenhagen, we land 1 week. 1 week later, we've found a place that we're going to stay for a month and a half. We know where the grocery store is. We know kind of all the different restaurants. We know where our daycare is. So we've kind of settled in. It's almost like we're not master budgeters. We actually just have learned to settle into a normal routine and normal lifestyle.
I have to ask you guys, you know, for most people who wrote us or contacted us, traveling with a kid is the exception. For you, it's the rule. Do you think that there are lessons from what you do that translate into somebody's weekend or somebody's summer vacation?
It's only just been through experience that we've reminded ourselves that for centuries and centuries and centuries, people have been taking their kids along with them in whatever they're doing in life, and that it's, you survive it, that it's possible. So for a weekend or vacation back home, if there are things that you used to do before you had kids, the kids adapt and it ends up being completely possible to take your kids. But there is that first little hump of fear and the stress of doing it for the first time to get over. But once you're over that, then it's a lot more smooth.
Jennifer Clayton and her family travel less frequently, but she's no less diligent about planning.
I think that being organized when you're traveling with kids is really half the battle. This is not the time to wing it. And so, you know, I have a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old, and we've been traveling with both of them since they were infants. And so I feel like we've done our time in the travel trenches. And if that's the one piece of advice I can share with other parents, it's prepping ahead of time, doing your due diligence.
You wrote us to consider shipping a box or two ahead of time. What made you start doing that?
Well, it really came out of, I have done a number of solo travel trips with my kids, and you can never have enough hands. You know, if you have the baby in the baby carrier, the baby is in the stroller, and you're holding the hand of the preschooler, and you have the backpack carry-on, and you're, you know, maybe your child has a carry-on that they're pulling or on their backpack, you know, just not having to deal with the whole luggage carousel hassle is huge. You know, you can either ship the actual luggage or you can ship boxes of items, and then they're there, they're ready, they're waiting for you when you get there.
Is there anything that you think of as that's like really unusual that you do that people wouldn't think of?
Renting items ahead of time. Most destinations have baby rental, toddler rental places where you can actually rent gear, because babies and toddlers come with a lot of stuff, you know. So if you're staying at a condo and you know you're going to be eating in, maybe you rent a high chair for a week, or you don't want to deal with the stroller on the airplane, or you don't have room for it if you're on a car trip, you rent a stroller at your destination. So I think that, you know, things like that, looking ahead and seeing what's going to make it easier.
Her other big tip? Pack lots of baby wipes. This started a big back and forth on our Facebook page about wipes, actually, and a lot of you are huge fans. We also wanted to bring in an expert on traveling cheaply with kids. So we turned to Frieda Moon. She writes the Frugal Family column for the New York Times. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much.
I looked at one of your recent columns, and it's just a whole paragraph, the first paragraph of stuff that you brought with you when you were traveling to Mexico with your baby. Baby blanket,
yes.
Burp rags, teething toy, bottles, et cetera, et cetera. That does not come cheap. So how do you keep the cost down?
One thing I have been really pleasantly surprised to find is that consignment shops for babies are really amazing.
Huh.
I'm not a big shopper in general. I'm not much of a stuff person or a gear person. But there are a few things that make it so much easier to travel with a kid. You know, a good light stroller, for example, or there's this ingenious device called a pea pod that we use all of the time. And, you know, they're not cheap new, but, you know, some of these things, we bought things off of Craigslist or at a consignment shop or hand-me-downs. I mean, people get so much baby stuff and then, you know, and then the baby outgrows it and they pass it on.
If you're looking out at all this stuff, and it is a little intimidating, are there specific places where people should look to save, should look for deals? You know, where can you cut?
For sure. Clothes, there are just enough baby clothes in the world that I don't know that we ever need to make new baby clothes again. I mean, it's just, you know, hand-me-downs from friends and family and or going to a consignment store. I mean, there's just a massive amount of baby clothes in the world that really don't need to spend money there. Really, most things, there's room for savings. There's not that much that you absolutely need. You need a good car seat and you need a good stroller, a baby carrier if that is your thing. But short of that, there's just not that much reason to lay down a lot of money on things that kids outgrow in months, is my experience, my limited experience so far. It's just not necessary. Better to spend the money perhaps on the trip itself.
What did you not see coming when you suddenly added a third to your family? And to your job.
Yeah. I think that, again, it's intimidating to look at a major life change when you don't really know what it's going to mean. And I think that I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to do what I had been doing. And I think, you know, again, what was surprising was actually how possible it was, how adaptable we are and how adaptable kids are, frankly. I mean, we have a very young daughter. She's only 11 months. So I think, you know, it's going to get harder. It's going to change. It's going to be different. She's different all the time. But I think that what has been remarkable to me is how traveling with a kid makes everything new and fresh and you know, sort of gives me a different perspective on something like camping, you know, sitting with a baby and watching her look up at the trees or look out at the water. It just gives me this sort of new excitement for places that maybe I would have gotten a little jaded about, You know, the amount that we travel, I'd like to say that I don't get jaded about it, but the reality is that you sort of do. And having a kid who's looking at everything for the first time makes it, you know, fresh and exciting again.
Frieda Moon is the New York Times Frugal Family columnist. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
For next week, we're sticking with this kids theme. We want to know, how do you teach your kids about money? And what's the biggest lesson you want them to learn? Go to marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or call us. We're 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be featured on the air. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. One statistic that gets tossed around a lot is that about two-thirds of the U.S. economy comes from consumer spending. That's not quite true. It's actually a little less than that and more complicated. But what is true is that what we buy and how we buy it has a big economic impact. And right now, the things don't look that hot for shopping at old-fashioned stores. Ralph Lauren, The Gap, Banana Republic, to name a few, all said they're closing stores. Sapna Maheshwari writes about retail at BuzzFeed, where she's a senior business reporter, and we asked her to help make sense of what exactly is happening right now to U.S. stores. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start with kind of a really basic question. What's a store now in 2016?
Well, they still exist, but the role of a store is changing. They're becoming fulfillment centers. They're becoming places for entertainment.
Fulfillment? What is a fulfillment center?
A place where they're shipping your online orders from more and more.
I'm sort of curious about, I guess, whether we should break this up. Like, when we think about where people buy stuff, should they be thought of in different buckets, like big box store, small store, online? Or how do you think about it?
Yeah, I've always thought about it as kind of the inner part of the mall, which is what we call specialty retail. So that's Gap and Banana Republic and all those stores. And then department stores, which is Macy's and JCPenney. And then all of the stores on the strip centers, so the TJ Maxx's and all of those. And they all have online components, but that online portion is obviously getting bigger all the time.
We asked people in a Twitter poll where they did their shopping, and I was struck. Almost half of them said online, but that was particularly for, you know, groceries and basics and stuff like that. So where do you see the kind of breakdowns? Are they by item or class of item, or are they by price point?
I would say it's sort of by brand. So like clothes, for example, that's a lot of stuff that people want to touch and feel, and sizing is really difficult. So it makes sense to go to a store for those things. And then on top of that, I would say brands that you care about or like to engage with, so maybe makeup brands, that becomes something maybe worth going to a store for.
It's been earnings season. We've seen earnings come in for some of these big retailers. If you look at, say, Macy's, that's kind of a bloodbath. What do you do if you're a great big department store right now?
You freak out. I think it's terrifying. There's a lot of layoffs. I mean, the big problem is, you know, really what you're getting at. What is the role of the store?
Yeah.
And if a store is supposed to be this engaging place for people to go to, then it has to be more entertaining. But that requires an investment. And so if there's less foot traffic, you are inclined to maybe invest less in your stores. And that's the, you know, puzzle that retailers are facing right now.
So let's take a store like Macy's. I don't want to pick on them, but they're a good example. What's going wrong?
Well, one thing that's going wrong is foot traffic at lower income malls. And so the way the mall industry views their malls is A, B, C, and D, where A is best and D is worst. And you can probably think of an A mall and a D mall if you think about where you grew up, if you grew up in a suburb. For me, it was the mall 45 minutes away. That was the really nice mall in Connecticut, and it had an Abercrombie and Fitch back when Abercrombie was cool, and the one 10 minutes away didn't have that. And we knew if we wanted to go buy a bunch of stuff, we'd go to the nice mall. And so it's those malls that aren't as, I guess, nice, don't have as many high-income shoppers, that aren't getting as much foot traffic or dollars, and the sales per square foot are really troubling.
So if you spin forward 5 years, are malls going away?
I think bad malls are going away, and that's becoming more and more clear. The mall industry has a lot of resistance to the fact that shopping is changing, but I think that so many retailers are struggling. I mean, you look at all the bankruptcies out of Aeropostale and PacSun, and a lot of others are struggling. So, I mean, they need to maximize their own sales and square footage. And so it's kind of looking like those bad malls are worth getting out of.
We cover inequality a lot on this show. And I was thinking about this before we came in here, wondering, you know, is there a fracturing also among income bands in terms of where people shop and what kind of stores are getting investment and what aren't?
I mean, definitely there are a few researchers that have looked at this, and the A malls, so we're talking malls that have an Apple store, that have maybe a Tesla dealership.
Wow.
They're just surrounded typically by a higher income person, more educated person, and that person's probably going to spend a lot more and brings like a certain kind of traffic to that place. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of a split happening.
If you had to put, I guess, a narrative on retail over the past, I don't know, 5 years, maybe even decade, how would you describe it?
I think it's really this industry like grappling with this huge shift in power. They don't know how to reach people. So I think the story for the past 5 to 10 years is, how do you deal with the internet?
Have they figured that out?
I don't think so. I mean, just in the past month, the Gap CEO was saying, you know, they're considering putting their products on Amazon. And that is just enormous. I mean, it really speaks to how differently retailers are viewing themselves, and the traditional metrics of success in the industry are changing dramatically. So before, it was a lot about foot traffic. Now they're really caring about clicks. And, you know, the CEO of Gap has really been open about that. But then how do you translate clicks to sales? And, you know, what are the conversion rates and what are the return rates on online orders? And these are all just huge questions.
I want to play a clip from the movie Mean Girls now. It came out about a decade ago.
Get in, loser. We're going shopping.
Okay, so that's post-Clueless, but the mall was still cool then. Is it anymore?
I don't know. I don't know if that's the coolest place for teens to hang out anymore. I don't know if mall rats would make sense, maybe, to a young person today.
And I guess that is probably the thing that underscores this decline of American retail.
Yeah. I mean, I think teens today, maybe they would go to the mall for Chipotle, or they would spend it on food, or maybe they'd go to a Dave and Buster's, but they're not going to the same stores that they used to. And I mean, that's a huge problem for a lot of brands that we've seen struggle.
Sapna Maheshwari is a senior business reporter for BuzzFeed. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're sharing the lessons that you teach your kids about money. Have a lesson of your own? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Raghu Manabalan. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer, and Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.